My name is Andy. I help people and organizations connect to purpose and make a difference in the world. In these wild and uncertain times, this podcast is an invitation towards better futures, exploring the mystery, beauty, and complexity of life through conversations with an array of incredible people, all of them working at the edge of what's possible for humanity. This is a place for big dreams, bold creativity, and fierce hope. Welcome to the Wonder Dome. If you're inspired by this conversation and you'd like to see it reach more people, you can help by sharing it with friends and colleagues, subscribing, giving us a 5-star rating, and best of all, leaving a glowing review. If you'd like to go even further, consider becoming a member of my small but mighty community of monthly supporters. You'll help me keep the lights on and provide funding to a wide range of charitable causes. You can learn more at thewonderdomepodcast.com. We've got a bit of a rarity here in the Wonder Dome, a first-timer, in fact. My guest today is Amy Fox, who recently joined me on the Wonder Dome for our conversation about trauma-informed leadership. And so Amy is returning again, which is not uncommon for the Wonder Dome, but what makes this one first-time rarity is that this conversation was recorded almost 2 years before our most recent conversation. For a variety of reasons, we weren't able to release it at the time, but now it's ready. We're ready to share it. And it's a bit of a bonus episode. So if you've heard my conversation with Amy already around trauma-informed leadership, then this will serve as a kind of backstory for how Amy came into this space and the opportunity she saw and how her and her sister worked together to build it, and along with many other people, and also the sort of seeds they were already planting back then, which have become much more explicit and clear about the power of transformation with a trauma-informed lens. If you haven't heard my other conversation with Amy, then this is sort of the foundation work here. And you'll have a great experience listening to them back to back. So we'll link to the most recent episode, the previous episode, which is more recent in chronological time, but serves as kind of a follow-up to the one you're going to hear today, which was recorded a couple of years ago. I'm really excited for you to hear these two side by side, and grateful for this time with Amy, who I think of as a real champion of the kind of leadership work that I feel the good fortune to do at my firm Konu, and all the amazing people and clients I get to work with, and the ways that I get to work with them. So much that is possible because of the vision of leaders like Amy. So let's get settled in. And hear again what Amy has for us. Hi, Amy.
Hey, Andy, wonderful to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome to the Wonder Dome.
Thank you.
It's really good to have you here.
I think I've waited all my life to hang out under the Wonder Dome, so I'm very happy to be here.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for saying that. You know, I that actually sparks something that I've been playing with, which feels like a fantasy at this particular moment, but something that might come to life in the future, which is that there might someday, in fact, be a Wonder Dome where people can hang out under and gather together. So I appreciate you stepping into kind of our co-created Wonder Dome here, and everyone who's listening, inviting them to step in with us too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm certain on the subtle planes that already exist.
So yes.
Just sitting in the future, that's all.
Yeah, yes, thank you. I feel that. I want to just sort of, for those who are listening, and also for your sake, because I haven't had a chance to say this to you in person, but I had the chance to attend this amazing community gathering that you and your sister created and have woven together over the years, called the Next Practice Institute. And that was, I guess, would have been in December of 2019, the last time that happened in person. That week was one of the most special weeks I've ever had in my life. Mm. And I was so struck by, many, many things, including I did the IFS track with Dick Schwartz, which just was like,
that changed everything for me. But outside of that kind of container, the larger container, I was struck by how generous and generative and playful and spontaneous it felt, even as there was this wonderful, rich structure kind of anchoring the whole space. It was just real. I've never been to a conference like that. And I want to really honor and say thank you for the love and care and energy that you've clearly put into that. And yeah, it was really special to me.
It's wonderful to hear you had such a rich experience and a soulful one. That week is really, for me, the culminative expression of a whole range of values that I think about in the transformational craft, and very definitely the expression of a lot of things I have strong conviction around. And you mentioned some of them. So the thought leadership and honoring the elders in the fields of organizational development and transformational change is very, very important to me. And I think many people are drawn to our field of practice without having had the privileged exposure to some of the people whose work is really the bedrock and foundation of what we're doing now. And so I feel like exposing those people and honoring them and bowing to them is a really important part of establishing the field of practice we're all going to hopefully embody and live out over the next several decades. So the keynote presentations, both for the seminal thought leaders, but also for the avant-garde cutting edge practitioners that are evolving our field of practice and expanding it, they're both very thrilling to me. And the rigor of study, of really putting a sort of line in the sand that says transformational work is a lifetime journey of refined mastery. It isn't can't be accomplished by taking a weekend workshop in one of these disciplines and hanging up a shingle. So for me, one of the beauties of NPI is that it's positioned as a joining a community and undertaking a adventure of lifelong learning together. And I love that people come back every year and do different tracks and meet different, have different conversations and interact with different parts of the nodes of our complex art form. And so that spontaneity of connection and joy of just discovery that you conveyed so beautifully, Andy, is very much part of the fabric of what I'm trying to create there. And then I think the last thing to say, and you sort of alluded to when you talked about Dick's work in internal family systems, is there's a strong belief that we have that transformational work starts with the practitioner as the instrument, and you have to do your own deep inner work in order to be able to accompany or catalyze other people's insights and growth. And so the week is designed not just to expose us intellectually and relationally to important practices, but to give people an opportunity to really do their own meaningful self-exploration and healing work in a professional context and with colleagues, as a way to consciously blur the boundary between personal and professional, which is the very same boundary we're intervening at in our client systems. So,
Well, as a data point of one, you nailed it. That was it. That was this, just the deep personal work, the community connection, the learning, the growth, the sense of, in particular, what you say about kind of the elders and the lineage they represent, like the sense of arriving somewhere that both simultaneously feels like home and also an undiscovered country, that there's just this incredible threads of energy and effort and thinking and feeling stretching back across generations that you presence in such a beautiful way. And it really is both humbling and inspiring to be in touch with.
Oh, that's so beautiful to hear.
Yeah.
I very much hope that if you think of Mobius not as an organization or as an entity, Mobius being the sponsoring organization that Erica and Alex and I founded that creates NPI, I don't think of Mobius just as a traditional boundaried firm. Like, we are Mobius with a team and practitioners, but Mobius as a movement, or Mobius as a naturally arising impulse of the universe towards restoration, then everyone who is themselves drawn to that contribution in life, anyone who feels themselves pulled to be a healer or a coach or an activist or somebody who's offering their life walk in the service of repair, whether it's local repair or global repair, ought to feel some sense of home when they arrive in a place that's devoted to that impulse or devoted to that intention. Mm. So I love that you felt it that way. And I hope that it is a warm, welcoming place for everyone who would see themselves or recognize themselves in what we just pointed to. And equally, I love what you said about the uncharted territory, because I always feel like I'm leading an organization that is very much trying to respond to and emerge from life signals. If you asked me 18 years ago, what's the strategic plan for Mobius? I would have said to try to follow God's will. And if you ask me 18 years later, I will tell you the same thing, which very much is challenging for my team trying to follow what they think I want to do. But it's still the truth. Like, I don't know where we're going. And I love that. I love that it reveals itself. It's an organization that's designed by revelation, not by architecture of intention. Or maybe it is architecture of intention in that I have a purpose, but it's not, I'm not micromanaging how it expresses itself.
That's beautiful. Gosh, there's so much I want to ask you now, just in what you shared. You've talked about kind of the driving values, which we've pointed towards. We've talked about lineage. There's this kind of practice of faith and emergence and let me just sit with that. I'm getting the image. There's this I can't think of his name, but there's someone who was there kind of drawing as the experience happened. And I'm not sure if he was the same artist who also made this image that was at the event of all of these different lineages and the way that they exist and flow into and emerge from each other. And I wonder if you could just say more about how you experience this territory that's both charted and uncharted. Like, what's your sense of the fields and how you're relating to it right now?
Well, you're referencing the wonderful graphic facilitation work of my colleague, Matthias Weitbrecht.
Matthias, yes. Yeah, he's masterful.
He is masterful, and they're both cartographies that he created. One where we've been privileged to have him with us every year at our annual gathering, mapping the terrain of all of the presentations and workshops and the spontaneous discourse that the community is evolving. And that's been a wonderful rendering to have as an artifact of our journey all throughout. But he also did work with me on two different presentations that I did, opening two of the different NPIs, in which I was trying to capture the multidimensional tributaries of thought leadership, practice, and spiritual underpinnings, maybe, or sort of etheric infrastructure that make up our field. And I was doing that in part because I really do think being a transformational practitioner obligates you to committing yourself to a very intricate walk of study that's ongoing. And it starts, as we've already said, Andy, with really a deep inner inquiry, a deep inner investigation, committing to your own healing work, your own integration, your own maturation, and actively looking for therapists and healers and practitioners who can guide that process and help shape it for you. And then cherishing them when you find them, really, not taking that as a casual exchange, but really apprenticing yourself to your own inner arrival. And that's, that's probably the most important dimension of being a change agent in any domain, because otherwise you will just take your own uncooked fears, beliefs, projections, and numbness and project that onto whatever it is you think you're intervening in. So if I can't see clearly, I can't help, really. And to the degree that I can clear up my sight and my observational ability and my presence to transmit and embody what I'm trying to teach, that's the degree to which I can have a really constructive, if not alchemical, impact. So it all starts as a foundation of self-development. And Mobius has been particularly privileged because my sister Erica, and I admit to sibling bias on this, but nonetheless, I think she's created an extraordinary leadership model in her work over the last 20 years at Harvard Law School called Winning from Within. Yeah. And what she uses Jungian archetypes as a way to help people really have a roadmap for understanding the different facets of their psyche and to unlock the sort of dormant capacities for transformation inside them. But regardless of the map, I think that the having a map and having an evolutionary walk in that self-development is the most fundamental thing people need to have. Mm. But after that, there's just a huge variety of disciplines from the work of the human potential movement to the work of family systems and understanding family roles and family dynamics, childhood development, adult development, moral development. And then you start looking at small group work and large group work and systems for understanding verbal interaction and interpersonal role locks and dynamics. And then you get to the level of team intervention and team theory, all the way out to thinking about larger culture change inside organizations. How do we help organizations to become more and more thriving, living human systems, to the larger cultural architecture of how do we build a more just and inclusive and peaceful world. So I think we want to be able to train practitioners to operate at every level of that micro macro holism. And in order to do that, our contention is you really have to study a huge variety of disciplines. And you don't have to be expert at all of them, but you have to at least have a panoramic understanding of the terrain.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting, as you sort of described that holism and that panorama, there's then the sort of way in which each of us might have our unique entry point to that panorama.
Exactly. Exactly.
And to the extent that we're as clean and clear about how we enter, like that will influence our capacity to be present and supportive to the needs of that panorama. If instead of what I'm hearing you say, though, that if we're not doing that work, if we come in with some projection of this is how things should be, or this is what I'm afraid of, and so I'm going to try and fix that in this kind of panorama or this holism, that actually produces, one of the big, I don't know if problems is the right word, but that's one of the big kind of root issues that it sounds like Mobius is standing for, which is to say, we're going to help you do your work so that you can do the work you're called to in the wider field. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a lovely articulation of that principle. Mm. Mm. And I, embedded in that also is an unconditional receptivity for wherever somebody enters. So I don't think of it as a prerequisite at all that in order to say, I feel pulled to this kind of work, you have to have finished your work. Quite the contrary. Every one of us is still doing our work. Yeah. Every one of us still has big blind spots and places where, we are stuck, and that's fine as long as you're working on them and you're getting supervision and you're getting support and you have the humility to say, this is my blind spot, I might need help here. I think, so I don't want at all to suggest that you have to be fully polished in order to start the work. I don't think that at all. I think the opposite. I think it's really about having a mature, extremely kind relationship with our stuckness and with each other's stuckness, and then building a community of practice in which we walk each other home.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. Beautiful. I love this. There's that home theme again. Mm. And there is an experience, I'll sort of speak from my first person experience, but there are many times in my life in the past where I have felt without a home. And the sort of pain and dislocation that comes with that feeling, even if I haven't always been able to name it, the sort of feeling of being outside or of trying to fit in somewhere that doesn't quite actually feel like it's where I need to be fitting in. But there's just like, so there's this sort of arrival at home that feels so important right now in this collective moment. Like, it feels like a lot of us are dislocated from a sense of home. And I wonder, just as I say that out loud, if that sparks anything for you and how you're kind of relating to that at the, maybe a bit more at the wider fields, kind of some of the bigger layers.
Well, if you don't mind, I'm going to start with a very intimate reflection of what you said, and then I'll work my way to the wider.
Yeah, great.
Because when you were speaking, I was thinking, why is this theme so precious to me? And I think it's because in my very early 20s, I was tremendously ill. I had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I was very young, and my peers and my friends were very young. And so for the most part, not universally, but for the most part, it was really hard for my friends to be my community while I was in treatment. And so I went to many of the 36 chemotherapy treatments by myself. And I think all of the 6 weeks of radiation treatment by myself. And I was incredibly kindly cared for by my nurses and doctors. So I felt very supported, but I really didn't feel that sense of, I don't know, a community or a safe holding or emotional, spiritual scaffolding underneath my very significant emotional and physical vulnerability. And I think that poignant and potent experience of the absence of community when I needed it really did something deep inside me in terms of my life purpose and what I then wanted to go on to create. And so I don't think it's by accident that 30 years later, my life's work is devoted to helping people feel that sense of belonging and interweaving and interdependence. So that's the first thing I would say.
As maybe they're working with some healing that they might want or need or be called into.
Very much so. Very much so. The second is, I think that we have a pandemic of independence in the world, and that because of generations of trauma and distance and emotional downregulation or disconnection or numbness, many of us and many organizations are walking around believing that the most evolved version of ourselves is self-reliant and independent and, quote, resilient. But actually, that's an utterly unnatural state. We really are meant to live in a village. We really are meant to need each other and to be generously giving to one another and to identify our self, not just as the boundary of our personhood, but everything that's in our ecosystem to tend to and steward. And if you think of yourself as broader than just your immediate family, but yourself is the well-being of every life you touch and every part of the fabric of life you can impact, then all of a sudden the interdependence becomes obvious and the implicate order starts to reveal itself. And then, as you said, Andy, so beautifully, the domain of my concern or the domain of my responsibility, the arc of what I'm beholden to, just gets wider and wider and wider, which is how you get to Walt Whitman's I Contain Multitudes, right? Yeah. It's really true. The cosmos is our responsibility. But that having that felt sense and letting your heart, you know, open and open and open till that becomes a palpable knowing, that's part of, I think, the art of awakening.
I'm struck with what you're describing as a really radical, and I mean radical in the sense that like radical means to touch the root, to like get to the root of something. It is radically counterculture. This culture you described, where we think that being isolated and fully independent, which by the way requires a lot of not looking at all the ways in which we are depending on all sorts of things at any given moment, requires like a lot of not looking.
Absolutely.
To say to someone who is arrived in that story fully and believes that so much, like I'm struck with the actual sort of tenderness and complexity of inviting a person or a group of people or an organization to find a way to see that story of independence as something that is producing quite a lot of hurt in themselves and in the people around them and in the people they touch in their work. And it just, these massive ripple effects of pretending that we're not connected ripple, like I think you used the word pandemic. It kind of ripples out in all the ways that we are connected. So I'm just struck with kind of the tragedy of that and the complexity of working with that. And I'm just curious, like how you've built an organization that is about, in a way, working with that. And it is quite counterculture. So I'm curious to hear how you kind of walk that and hold that.
Well, maybe I have good news. So on the one hand, I agree with you. It is very radical what I'm saying, because I'm really attempting, and we are as Mobius attempting to help organizations to look really starkly at the cost of treating their system in mechanistic ways versus humanly thriving ways. Like if you are anti-body, anti-spirit, anti-emotion, anti-relationship, what does that do to people? And I believe that we're seeing those costs in mental health strain, in burnout and exhaustion, in physical health and absenteeism, difficulties, health challenges. We're seeing the symptoms of that very unnatural way of relating in many companies. And so the good news is, as radical as it is to say starkly and candidly, this doesn't work and we need to change it. The good news is almost immediately anybody who's been living inside of that world for any period of time, when you literally articulate, it doesn't have to be that way, and you give them a palpable felt sense of the alternative. Spend a week with us immersed in a container that is consciously safe, consciously loving, consciously attuned to the uniqueness of who you are, interested in the generations of your ancestry that shape who you are and why your fears are the way they are, interested in the beauty and potential you bring into life, capable of holding your pain. And you train people in that group to do that for each other, which turns out to be the most natural impulse of the heart. You don't have to teach people to want to do that. You just have to give them license, permission, and structure. And then once you've done that, you start to see the most amazing, mind-blowing, inspiring exchanges, because all of us have a natural resonance with one another. We're wired to care. We're wired to want to love well. So if you get rid of the constraining forces or the normative dampening down that many of us live with all day long, and you create a container for even a short period of time that operates by a counterculture set of norms, exactly that, Andy. My experience is with thousands of executives across every industry and every part of the world over now almost two decades, almost everyone melts, because it is the wind is at your back. Let me say it that way. Life wants to heal. Yeah. Life knows how to heal.
Yeah.
People want to connect. We know how to be a tribe. And all you really have to do is help people to feel their own longing and to have the courage to try something else and be in a safely experimental, playful context, to be gawky and make requests and make little gestures of friendship and little gestures of confidence. And then every time somebody makes a move, you amplify it, you celebrate it, you acknowledge it, and you literally teach people how to slow down and hear each other, how to respond emotionally to emotional content, how to celebrate each other's beauty, how to breathe in the natural environment to restore themselves during a day, how to talk about their lives in reflective, meaning-making ways, like all the tools of intimacy. You're really teaching. It's teaching corporate intimacy, really.
I was out for a walk a couple weeks ago, walking down a paved road, and having an experience of sadness, like, look at this paved road. What used to be here were trees and plants and mushrooms and wildlife. And then something came. I just had a felt sense almost of the trees or of nature being like, oh, that's nothing. The moment you stop putting down the pavement, like, we'll be back. And it was just so clear that we have to work so dang hard to keep paving this story of independence, of I can do it all myself. I don't need love. I don't need connection. We just have to keep paving that. But what I hear you describing is this kind of this lived experience of, look, you just stop paving for a minute, stop. And then look, the shoots start coming up. The flowers start to blossom quite quickly.
Oh, that's just a glorious reflection of what I said. That's exactly my experience. Just you said it so beautifully, Andy. Just stop paving for a moment.
Well, I'm really touched to hear that you're seeing that first person experience. And I'm finding myself curious, like, I want to hear a story of that. And I know I didn't ask you to prepare one before. So feel free to, if this feels interesting, like, to the extent that you feel like you could share a moment where you're like, I can't believe I'm witnessing this, or maybe it's something that happened for you, a moment where you're like, this is a shift for me or for my client or for this group. Maybe we can bring that to life even more for folks who are hearing this going like, oh, I've never seen that in my office place, or like, I've never touched that before.
Well, I think it's probably an important calibration to say that our particular, the kinds of workshops I'm alluding to, which is only a subset of the ways Mobius works with business clients, but the deeper transformational programs are really very uniquely set up. So we wouldn't do it in your workplace, you're right. We wouldn't do it casually in the middle of your work day. And it would be inappropriate and unskillful to ask you to, you know, try to do that. The shift would be too awkward.
Yeah.
And the risk would be too high. So these programs in which we're asking people to really explore, experiment with, and embody a new way of being are done in a retreat environment over 4 or 5 days. With a very high faculty to participant ratio, with very methodical and systematic curriculum for dropping out of ordinary consciousness and into this kind of more cutting edge self-discovery mode, and then coming back out into regular leadership capacities and applying them to how they're going to lead and change the culture in more transformational ways when they return back to work. So there's a whole almost like a Otto's U process of discovery, of leaving the ordinary world, experimenting and dreaming and imagining, and then a sort of return, or you know, Erica describes that also using Joseph Campbell's metaphor of a hero's journey. So these are very consciously crafted leadership interventions. If you're asking for anecdotes coming out of that, there's so many, many beautiful moments. I could say that the most poignant ones, I think, that happen now are where somebody's telling the story of family challenge or trauma that goes back 2 or 3 generations, people who came out of a war context or an immigration story or a poverty context or a place where there was corporal punishment for children, where they've had a really significant, often many generations, traumatic experience. And the program is often the first time they've ever told that story to colleagues. In some cases, the first time they've ever allowed themselves to be seen for the pain that that story lives in their life and in their children's life. Add the holding and support to really go back and look at the emotional impact of those stories, and have holding and appropriate accompaniment to unsurface some of the memories and sensations and feelings attached to the impact of those stories in their lives. And at the end of the week, you can literally see people look unburdened. They look uplifted and lighter. They look more embodied and free. They're more spontaneously who they are in their face and their body and their self-expression. And their, we often start on Monday, and we have dance breaks every day for 3 times a day. And on Monday and Tuesday, the only people dancing are the Mobius people. And on Wednesday and Thursday, maybe we have half the group, but by Friday we have everybody. And I always take that as a sign of like, everybody got there, which is wonderful.
That's a great way to read the room.
Of course, you know, I'm not naive to believe that those 5 days are the healing journey. Those 5 days allow people to see that there is a healing journey. I really always feel like the goal of those 5 days is simply for people who may not have had the privileged exposure that you and I and many people listening to this call have had of self-development and personal growth work, and knowing that there are resources and tools for living a, you know, unburdened, lighter life, suddenly see that that's a possibility. And that glimpse of possibility may then become a motivation to start getting help and and looking inward. And that's wonderful when it does. And if it's just a moment in time, that's a glimmer of a possibility of who they are and who they could become. Maybe it comes to fruition a decade later. That's also wonderful. I don't have a particular story arising, but that's what came to me.
I'm really touched by that. Yeah. And I think this maybe connects back to what I was describing about feeling at home when I arrived at NPI, and also times in my life where I felt without a home, is this sense that we don't really have many spaces. Maybe there are two things here. One, I was never I'll speak for myself. I was never educated in my ancestral history. Mm-hmm. I was as a privileged white American, I arrived into a context that said implicitly and explicitly, this is who you are. And maybe there were some history classes about some pilgrims came and landed on, the story was very simple and very unconnected to the much deeper, wider, more complex ancestral lineage that we all carry. So there's no education really around that. And then there aren't really spaces where anyone talks about that as adults. There's this emerging interest in getting a DNA test, 23andMe, and that's really cool. There's some stuff emerging. People are curious about this, but there's something really beautiful that I'm touched with where you're creating spaces where people can perhaps for the first time in their life, both become aware of the deeper, more complex story, and also become aware of the way that that story is living in them, even if they've never had a chance to talk about it with anyone. And that to talk about it is a kind of unburdening, is a kind of a chance not to erase that past, but rather to bring it further and more fully into their life in a way that they can hold it and carry it and learn from it, as opposed to simply being burdened by it without really knowing what the burden is or why it's there. So I just really touched by the beauty of that possibility that more people are getting in touch with where they came from. And as a result, where they might be going now that they can choose that they didn't have access to before.
Yeah, and just to add one more maybe esoteric dimension, my mystical belief would suggest that when each of us does that work on behalf of our families, it brings peace to the ancestors and possibilities to the next generation.
Thanks for saying that. Yeah, that's really landing with me right now. I'm really curious now at this moment, how, and maybe this is part of the emergent value that you named near the top of our call, but one crucible experience you named was experiencing Hodgkin's lymphoma and kind of going through that alone. And now there's this community value that's so present in Mobius. How, to the extent that you feel like you can tell this story, and maybe this is hours and hours of storytelling, but there's some way in which you emerged into this realization that this was your work to do, and that it was that you could do it in or leadership and organizational context, right, as opposed to therapeutic context or educational context, but there's this kind of here is the place where I, Amy, am going to help us show up. And I just wonder if you could speak to that in whatever way you feel called to in this moment.
Such a generous question. Probably it is several hours of an answer, but let me see if I can give you a few.
Yeah, let's play with it.
The first thing to do is to just bow to my experience in my late 20s. So from 1989 to 1997, I had the amazing honor of working at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York. And at that time, the dean, Reverend Morton, and Paul Gorman, my immediate boss, and I were the public affairs office of this 5,000-person structure that was a hotbed of consciousness and activism. And really lived at the intersection of liturgy, social activism, sustainability, community service, and cosmology. And so I got an extraordinary apprenticeship, getting exposed to some of the great change makers of our time, some of the great theologians of our times, and some of the great culture thinkers of our time. And that apprenticeship shapes everything that my work in life became. So I take very seriously the mentorship and who shows up in your life as guides and teachers. And I certainly know that my time with both of them and with Carl Sagan and with then Vice President Gore became very formative experiences in shaping my understanding of how to do large scale change and how to create, and as you said so beautifully in our meditation before we started, Andy, a ripple out into a lake, and that you don't have to know all the things the ripple is going to do. If it's a good and noble and worthy ripple, then set the stone in the water. And I learned a lot from each of them about how to set stones in the water. Yeah, it's one way to say it. Not only about the sort of impulse to activate change, but also the urgent interdisciplinary nature of those impulses. That you couldn't do them. The scientists couldn't work on climate change without faith leaders, and faith leaders and scientists couldn't change public policy without influencing the political leadership of our country. And the interwoven need for multi-stakeholder dialogue and multidisciplinary penetrating wisdom. That those were two of the things that I took away from experience.
Sounds like incredibly fertile territory.
You know, it's truly an extraordinary experience. The cathedral would be a several hour podcast unto itself. in any event, I then really had a very intimate period of investigation, moving from macro level change to micro level change, and spent a number of years getting a master's in counseling, working in a methadone clinic, working in an alcohol rehab center, working in a domestic abuse center, working in a holistic health center, trying to look at how do you do change, not just at a macro level of public policy and large scale theological teaching, but also at the really nitty gritty cold front of a family or an individual with, you know, wounding. And then that it was sort of natural to think, okay, well, what are the domains that might bridge those two and have a macro level impact and a micro level sense of high touch proximity. Right around the time that I was asking that question, Erica, my sister, very graciously invited me to be one of the psychotherapists that was teaching Harvard Law School's Difficult Conversations material. A wonderful book by her best friends, Doug Stone and Sheila Heen, and our friend, Bruce Patton. And I had the wonderful experience of teaching that book in the business setting for about a decade. That was the translation from my world of sort of social change into the world of business consulting and leadership development. And the impulse to start Mobius was really in part in preparation for wanting to build a platform for Erica's book, and which we knew was going to be a very radical and sort of galvanizing and important contribution to the field of leadership development. But equally, I think Eric and Alex and I, our three founders, saw a window of trying to start to introduce psycho-spiritual intelligence and tools. It was the time when mindfulness was starting to get explored at through the Center for Contemplative Mind, and Search Inside Yourself was getting founded at Google. And there was a larger embrace in the culture of yoga practices and more martial arts practices. And you could just start to see a kind of opening or sort of flexibility that was going to arrive into the culture. And we were probably a little bit ahead of when the business world embraced all of that. And I hope we made a contribution to the business world embracing all of that. But I always felt like the structure of business had such an ethical misalignment in many, many cases at the core, and that was going to ultimately have to be corrosive and exposed. And at the moment when it would be exposed, however that happens, whether it's out of personal dissatisfaction of employees or institutional misalignment and institutional, breakdown, everybody then is in the sort of equivalent of an alcoholic asking for help. They hit a kind of bottom. And in that moment of bottoming, to be there as a ready resource to say, you know, there is something else possible. And we can help you, you know, top team to talk to each other in ways that are high functioning and synergistic and creative instead of dysfunctional and abusive and mean-spirited and fear-inducing. Or we can help you, company X, you know, to make a move from feeling like you don't have an aligned purpose to feeling like you have an igniting purpose. Or we can help you, individual person, you know, to come back into your own well-being. Yeah, it's beautiful to be a refuge resource.
Yeah, there is I love that word refuge. There's a quality of arriving somewhere where you can really be safe, at least for the time that you're there. And maybe from that safety emerges new possibilities that you can bring back out into the, as you leave the sanctuary, to kind of bring back out into the, into your life and your work.
No, I love that you said sanctuary. I love thinking of the week as a sanctuary. Mm. There was, I led a program 2 weeks ago for frontline workers in a very, very industrial industry, which I'll leave anonymous for the moment. And on the last day, that one of the guys said, when I logged into the Zoom on Monday, I had the thought, he paused and he said, I don't know why. And then he unpaused and he said, I had the thought, this is a safe and trustworthy place. Mm. And it really, it caused me to tear up, Andy, because I thought it's not his conscious mind that's making the assessment. Is this a safe and trustworthy place? It's his intuitive willingness to heal that's making that assessment. And he even knows he doesn't know where the thought came from.
He's like, I don't know why I thought that.
I don't know why. And I just loved that. And I was like, yeah, because a wholer part of you had that understanding. And I just love the juxtaposition of his likely cynicism with the part of him that was a willing yes.
And that was on like that. You're saying this was on the day he arrived. He already had that intuition.
He said, literally, he said, when I logged into the Zoom, I had the thought, I don't know why, this is a safe and trustworthy place, which also speaks to something we haven't touched on, which is how important I think the energetics of the work is.
Yeah.
So the safety comes from a quality of love and friendship and devotion that's built into the fabric of our work. And I think it's built into the fabric of many, many of the companies that we have the privilege to align with and partner with. All of us are trying very hard to bring a quality of mature love into the world. Mm. And that's a felt sense between us. It's a felt joy at the annual gathering, as you referenced, but it's also a palpable field that when participants, you know, arrive to the room or quote, join the Zoom, as the case is more and more these days, there is a kind of implicit telegraph or transmission of a quality of warmth and I mean, it's overtly warm and kind and welcoming, but it's also implicitly, implicitly sending signals as well. And I think part of the signal really comes from the fact that all of us have walked our own painful recovery journeys. So you can make a warm welcome that's hollow and sort of hallmarky, and that will not produce people's bodies feeling like I can arrive with my truth and I can bring my shadow work here. It will, in fact, leave people feeling like in order to participate, I have to be kind of gleeful and happy and disconnect from whatever is dark and painful in my life. But if they walk into the room and that warmth is sitting alongside a transmission of, we really are prepared to hear even the darkest dimensions of life, then people feel like they can really arrive.
Yeah. Oh, there's this, I'm thinking back to what you were saying earlier about how quickly people start to receive the possibility that they can actually do this. And you're speaking to something that feels so important to name here, which is, especially over Zoom, which is like, we have this capacity to sense and and choose whether or not a place is safe for us very, 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 very quickly, even over Zoom, right? Like there's something coming through that this person you spoke to modeled that most of us aren't consciously aware of all the time. There's something coming through. And to the extent that what I'm hearing you say, that you and your team can show up sitting in your room by your computer in front of your camera, 100 miles away, 1,000 miles away from this person, you would think like, oh, well, no, there's nothing. I mean, how could he feel that? And yet, nonetheless, here it is, this evidence that without saying a word, how we show up and what we bring in as we show up is influencing and impacting the other person. And it speaks to that like natural receptivity that we keep trying to pave over, but is actually like right there the moment we give it space.
Yeah. And I mean, I absolutely adore what you said. And I also think activating that intuitive sensing and helping transformational leaders being able to slow down enough to get that information, discern that information, and make meaningful meaning of that information is part of what we're training them to do.
Yeah.
So it's a parallel process. I mean, it's a melting for them personally, but it's also a refining of a transformational capacity that I think is critical in leading in complexity.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to say one more thing about safety, because when you were speaking, I thought of a beautiful teaching that my teacher, Thomas Hubel, has about the reverence for the defense system. So part of what makes a setting like we're trying to create, quote, safe, psychologically safe and emotionally safe, relationally safe, is that we don't have an agenda that people drop their defenses at all, or certainly in a certain amount of time or under pressure. Mm. And if we are looking to decide that we're doing a good job or the program's working by somebody else having a cathartic experience, there's going to be a kind of performance pressure on their psyche that's going to actually do the opposite of letting them drop in. And so honoring the defense systems, noting them, bowing to them, recognizing them, celebrating them for their extraordinarily survival-oriented, unique intelligence at the moment of inception, right? Every dysfunctional thing that is showing up in the room, Thomas has this beautiful phrase, was once a childhood hero, was at some point the most intelligent thing that person could do to keep their psyche intact. So you have to treat it as intelligent, high functioning and important, or else it's not going to have any possibility of unwinding in your presence. So it is absolutely true that there's an immediate sense of safety, and then you earn that safety by the willingness to be guided by their psyche, not by your own agenda.
I have learned that lesson the hard way more times than I care to share. And it's just so true. It's so true that the more we strive to fix, solve, or save someone else, the harder we're going to make it for us to just simply connect. So that respect for all of the choices, many of which have been unconscious, that a person has made, or that some part of them has made as they've moved through their life, has been deeply anchored in what they needed to get as far as they've gotten. Yeah, there's like a real, there's something really humane and respectful and kind of sacred about just saying like, you're not broken.
Yeah.
You're human.
Yeah.
And if you want to work with these questions of how you let go or evolve or heal, we're here for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's lovely. I mean, Buddhism has this wonderful concept of causes and conditions, and that the sort of understanding of karma is the cumulative sum total of causes and conditions. And I have a sort of similar thought about facilitation. I'm creating the causes and conditions in which healing might happen. And that includes thinking about everything from what music to play, what poetry to include, what pauses to take, what moments of highlighting something that's just been said in the room so that everybody can let it reverberate in them. You know, all those little micro choices create the causes and conditions for possibility, for new life.
Yeah, beautiful. So as you sit with this beautiful stance of being in service of the causes and conditions that might, that allow for the possibility of healing. I wonder what you sense is emerging in your work or in the larger fields, like where you talked about kind of listening for that revelation. What are you sensing is emerging now after the in the wake of this year and a half of racial reckoning and social reckoning and this global pandemic? Like there's something going on, is my sense. Obviously, there's something going on. How are you relating to that something? What's emerging, and what are some of the causes and conditions that you're paying attention to as we think about this question of healing and moving forward?
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly as a longtime social justice activist, I'm in awe of the escalation of awareness that's happening. Mm-hmm. And I hope that Mobius is acting as an ally of that movement. And I'm also very modest about the work that isn't mine to do. Mm. So Mobius has a partnership with a wonderful firm called Seven Stones Leadership that does racial inclusion and healing work, founded by our friends Jen Cohen and Gina LaRoche. And I am watching them get invited to do extraordinarily meaningful affinity group work in very big corporations who are suddenly looking at the experience of diverse employees with a much greater willingness to hear the challenges. I think there's a lot more truth telling happening in those conversations than I've certainly ever seen in my 20 years of consulting to businesses. And I think the impulse or mandate for systemic change is not going to go away. I think that's, you know, once the stories can be told, then the information is in the system and the urgency for change is, the mandate for change is well placed at the table. So I think that the Black Lives Matter movement has already had a profound and permanent impact on how business thinks about advancing diverse leaders and diversifying the workplace and changing the culture of the workplace to be more diversity informed. So that's all wonderful. And I think where organizations are doing it in a token way, that will become more and more obvious and and more and more insufficient. I think we're in a bit of a redemptive moment, and that, you know, sort of truth will out. You know, anything that isn't being done at the depth that's required and with the congruence and commitment and willingness that's required will over time fall apart, will fall apart. So, but there are many inspiring examples of people really trying to look and have the hard conversations and willing to go through the sort of sludge of deep dialogue, which requires, you know, it's hard work. As we all know, it's very hard work. So I really admire the people that are guiding that process, and I admire the companies that are embracing that process. And very much Mobius tries to include, as you can hear, the sort of lineage story dimension of that work in our understanding of what it means to even do any leadership development. You can't do it without an understanding that it includes culture, lineage, ancestry, religious history, you know, immigration stories, all the things we talked about earlier, Andy. So I don't want to make it sound overly bifurcated, like leadership's over here and racial healing is over here. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. I think these are parallel waves, but they also require a very specific expertise to do the affinity work, in my view.
Yeah, that's that entry into the wider panorama that some people are going to
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm. That's a lovely way to say it. That's exactly right. Mm. And if you're just asking about the cutting edge, I don't feel like I need a new one. I'm endlessly fascinated by people's stories. And, you know, I almost always cry at the end of these programs when I look at the light pouring out of people and think about the state they were in when they entered and the state they're in when they leave. It's a miraculous thing, and always more than I can quite attribute in time and space. So I guess the cutting edge is the same old. Watching the miracle of transformation is the future for me anyway.
I recently finished a book called Underland by Robert McFarlane. Mm. And he tells a story. There's a place in I think it's in Norway or it might be in Finland. There's a peninsula. And to get to, there's only two ways to get to this peninsula. Either you hike over the fjords, which are pretty much permanently, this is so far north that they're pretty much permanently encased in snow and ice, or you sail around and into the bay. And you have to have good weather for the sail because otherwise you'll be dashed upon the rocks. And at the end of this peninsula, there's a cave. And inside the cave, there are two paths. And at the end of one path is a room. And inside that room, there are figures, dancing figures painted on a wall. And the miracle that we as a, I was reading his story of journeying to that cave and being in touch with the miracle that we as a species can find our way anywhere. And if we choose, bring beauty to those dark places. I feel that that's what you just spoke to. Like that is what you're holding for. It's not that we need some new solution, but rather we simply need to keep creating spaces where those of us who are ready can walk out to that peninsula of our lives and find or make something more beautiful than was there before. So thank you for like creating that space in the world. It's really awesome to hear.
I love that. Mm-hmm.
Amy, as we approach, I want to have the 2-hour conversation about St. John's Cathedral. There's so many other conversations that we could have, but as we approach the time boundary of this conversation, I'm just curious what you're present to that you feel called to share in this space for anyone who might be listening.
Mm. Well, 2 things. If the conversation Andy and I have been having resonated with you in any way and you want to study a little bit more any of the themes that we've been pointing at, on our Mobius website, you can find the archives of a decade of magazines open source there. And I welcome you to go poke around and find ideas that might ignite you or spark you and hopefully books that you might want to read and ways to continue studying. And I'd be only delighted if us having put that content there is a resource for anybody that's listening to keep walking their walk. Yeah. That's wonderful.
Beautiful. We'll definitely share that in the show notes and stuff. Too. It's such a great archive of possibility.
Thank you for that, Andy. Yeah. And the other is maybe just to say one further comment. We've been talking in very psychological and cultural terms for this conversation and implicit, but I think I want to make it explicit. This is also work of devotion and work of prayer and work of surrender and work of grace. And I don't believe any of the beauty that we're seeing in our work or many of us are seeing in the privacy of our consultation rooms or the depth of the repair that's happening in our coaching conversations or the power of team intervention, all the ways everybody listening is working. So much of it is being turbocharged by life's innate desire for restoration. And I just wanted to acknowledge that as we close, that we're all in a field of grace and very blessed in to do this work and blessed in the work, and may the work be a blessing.
Thank you, Amy. Beautiful. Thanks everyone for listening in. So we'll make sure to include links to the Mobius website in the show. And yeah, this has been a real treat. Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning into the Wonder Dome. This podcast was produced by me, Andy Cahill, with support from Kaylee Serqua, and post-production by Jim Serqua of Sump Pump Studios. The Wonder Dome is recorded and produced primarily on unceded Nipmuc territory. I honor their ongoing leadership and stewardship of the land. I trace my own ancestral roots to Celtic peoples from Ireland and Scotland, and to Anglo and Germanic tribes across northwestern Europe. We all come from somewhere, we're all going somewhere. May the wisdom of our ancestors guide us, and may we find our own wisdom along the way. The theme song was written and performed by Todd Marston. You can find the Wonder Dome wherever pods are casted. If you dig what we're doing here, please share widely, subscribe, and give us some love on the review boards. If you feel called to support this humble offering while making an even greater impact in the lives of others, consider becoming a monthly supporter. You can find out more at my website, thewonderdomepodcast.com. Until then, I'm wishing you a life of purpose, power, and presence. We need you now, more than ever.